Welcome to Friend of Maryland. My name is Kat Pause, and this is a fat-friendly space. Today on Friend of Maryland, I share Leslie Kinzel's great new piece about glorifying obesity. I chat with Dr. Leah Sweet from Parsons University, and I spotlight a piece from The Fat Chick about having a big body means you're doing it all wrong. I wanted to start off the show today by sharing a piece by Leslie Kinzel that was recently on Exo Jane. The piece is called, "I Guess I'm Glorifying Obesity Just by Existing. Is This a Problem?" And it was published on October 25th, 2012. Quote, 2 weeks ago, 18-year-old NYU student Stella Boonshoft posted a picture of her underwear clad size 12 body on Tumblr, along with a brief manifesto of sorts. The image has since gone viral, as the kids say, with Boonshoft eventually taking a turn on the Today Show to discuss the reaction, which has been overwhelmingly positive. This follows on the heels of a Wisconsin news anchor's rebuttal earlier this month to the man who wrote to her explaining that her non-thin body, simply being visible on television, was sending a dangerous message to the nation's youth. People rallied behind Jennifer Livingston, too, in a rare show of support for awesome public fattery. Around these parts, we're familiar with this happy reaction inspired by a diversity of allegedly imperfect bodies. Seeing bodies that look like our own showcased in media like this gives us all a change of recognition, but it's also oddly validating. Or maybe it's not odd in the least, considering we derive so much of our values from the media we consume. And seeming ourselves deemed worthy of attention by the same media is a pretty awesome ego boost. The positive response to these examples definitely bodes well for a culture that may be changing to accommodate and appreciate that bodies come in all varieties, and I'd like to just herald it as a triumph and call it done. But the fact is that this praise is also happening in context with opinions published in an op-ed earlier this month, in which the author advocates for more shaming of fat people, not less. The basic idea being that, sure, what's under the skin matters, but not as much as having the self-consciousness to not gross out the other people on the beach with you. And although the positive support of both Stella Boonshoft and Jennifer Livingston has been vocal, there's also been criticism. Sure, some of it is the standard schoolyard, ew, gross, taunts, if that can rightly be considered criticism. But much of it foregoes the obvious put some clothes on approach in favor of claiming a certain level of intellectual merit and care for these poor fat people. You know, the concern trolls. The concern trolls are the people who pop into these conversations that they have no problem with how a fat person looks, but they are just worried about their health or their mental state or the effects of their heaving out-of-control bulk on the cost of health insurance or gas prices or a gallon of milk or the price of beans. They are consumed with worry. It's all they seem to think about. The concerned trolls are the individuals who say that it might be fine to have a tiny bit of self-esteem there, fatty, but in doing so, you might also be glorifying obesity. A charge I've personally been hearing for years upon years upon years. And since, culturally speaking, obese bodies are not simply occupied by their owners, but are occupied by everyone who can see them. The concerned trolls feel entitled to have a say in directing how those fat people think about their bodies and how they choose to present their bodies in public. This is not an effect exclusive to fat bodies. Women, for example, are subject to the same occupation, in which even strangers can feel entitled to often commentary or advice on the state of their body, fat, thin, whatever. But it is one that is particularly applied to fat folks because current trends dictate that fat people are a problem that needs to be solved. Thus, glorifying obesity is depicted as a dangerous virus, implying that if fatness is allowed to spread unchecked, our culture and civilization are at risk of cataclysmic destruction, possibly in a hail of donuts. The thing is, this is actually kind of true. If obesity continues to be quote-unquote glorified in the manner described, by allowing fat people to be on television, to share pictures of themselves feeling good about their bodies, to wear bikinis, to enjoy eating, and so forth, the social fabric of our current body culture in the United States would be severely threatened. Some of the dangers of glorifying obesity might include Young girls might not fear getting fat more than they fear nuclear war, losing their parents, or cancer. Fat people might no longer be at an increased risk of having their illnesses misdiagnosed or diagnosed late by doctors working in a new medical community in which disdain for fat bodies is rampant, or given the wrong dosages of medicine, both of which can cost millions in unnecessary treatments and prolonged treatment. Eating disorders, which admittedly are not exclusively about weight, but which are cultivated by a culture that identifies fatness as a failure of control, might no longer be a central fear in the lives of 10 million Americans. We might not have a weight loss industry that generated $60 billion in revenue in the United States last year, mostly by making women feel like crap about themselves. Fat people might not have to worry about whether seats on airplanes or in restaurants or basically anywhere they go can physically accommodate them. Dudes might not yell at me in random parking lots. Fat people everywhere might develop a powerful self-respect and demand respect from others and might be less likely to suffer bullying and shaming in silence. Fat people might not be so handy for scapegoating, schadenfreude, and cheap laughs, or as a means by which others can feel superior. And people of all sizes might feel better about themselves because no one would be wasting energy and focus worrying about what would happen to them, how their life would be ruined, if they became fat. Many of us are willing to back up Stella Boonshoft and Jennifer Livingston because we recognize them as individuals. They're not an epidemic. They're not a threat to national security. They're not selfish gluttons using up all the healthcare. They're people. What shame-centered obesity epidemic rhetoric accomplishes better than anything else, better even than its purported intention to improve public health, is to erase the humanity of fat people. Because all those obese folks clogging the overstated statistics are, in fact, still people. They're friends and coworkers, moms and dads, children and grandparents. You know some of them. You probably like them. You probably don't think of them as an epidemic or as posing a clear and present danger to the future of humanity. If reminding folks that fat people are people first, that they are individuals and not some monolithic amoeba of disease rolling itself over the planet, and that their bodies are not shameful, not ugly, not embarrassing, not immoral, but as worthy of acceptance as every other body. If this is the same as glorifying obesity, then bring on the glory. I will carry the banner. I won't be sorry, not for my part in changing our culture around bodies in general, and not for my own body that I live in right now. I won't be sorry, and I won't apologize. Neither should you. End quote. Joining me today is Dr. Leah Sweet, an adjunct professor of art history at Parsons in New York City. Leah, thank you so much for coming on Friend of Marilyn.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so just so the listeners know, I actually know Leah. She's one of my few guests who, like, I physically know. She came to the conference I hosted earlier this year at Massey, and we got to hang out at the conference, and then she stayed in New Zealand a bit longer, so we hung out for another day after that, which was awesome.
Yes. I had such a great time. New Zealand's a wonderful place.
Well, we were glad that you're here, and we're happy to have you back anytime. I have a guest room. So
I'm going to take you up on that.
Excellent. Now, when you were here for the conference, what you talked about were ways that you introduced issues of fatness into the classes that you taught at Parsons in art history and design. So I'm hoping that you'll talk about that today on the show so I can learn a little bit more about that and so my listeners can hear about the work that you're doing as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, just as the fact that they're at Parsons, these are the people who are producing our future material culture, the spaces we're going to be in as well, the things that we're going to be wearing, graphic design, all these kind of things. I just felt it really important to introduce this notion of just fat rights and issues of fatness in relationship to identity to students who don't are not normally actually fat themselves and to expose them to that.
So how do you, I mean, how do you work that into your curriculum?
Well, I found that it's actually quite effective to build a curriculum that addresses either issues of identity, such as a self-portraiture class that I'm teaching this semester, or in relationship to issues of civic responsibility, agency, and social justice. So it's usually a segment in a larger class.
And how do your students respond to that?
Mostly quite positively, actually. I taught a segment on queering fat bodies, actually, within contemporary self-portraiture just a couple of days ago. And they were incredibly engaged and into it and really loved the readings and such. And I think after a whole semester of dealing with issues of identity and what is an authentic or natural body and kind of getting rid of those ideas of one standard and then something that deviates from it, they were very well prepared to receive that. And I was just delighted to see how, you know, the energy with which they were discussing these issues.
So you said that there are readings involved. What kinds of things did you have them read?
For this week?
Yeah.
Well, we read three texts. One was Katie Lebesco's Queering Fat Bodies in Politics as a kind of general theory piece. And we had definitely talked about notions of gender and sexuality and performance beforehand. They also had a reading on Jenny Saville and a feminist aesthetics of disgust, so that visual component where they're literally looking at these paintings and talking about it. And then another one on Lee Bowery, Queer in Fashion, Queer in Art by Alison Bancroft.
That's so awesome. I want to come take your class.
It was great. These are really very dense material, but we really pieced through them together. And actually, I was quite impressed with how much they identified with and really got what these readings were about.
Do you find that there's a kind of shift in your students in the sense of, you know, at the beginning, they might seem like a bit incredulous in terms of like, why are you bringing this kind of material in to this class that has nothing to do with that? But then by the end, where they seem to kind of get it and see why it's important?
I definitely structure my classes to in increments. So first off, it's just as in this self-portraiture class, you know, what is representing a self if we're talking about self-portraiture? What are issues of identity? Is identity stable? You know, and so by the time we're kind of build up to these concepts, I really have encountered very little resistance when I say, okay, let's take what we've learned so far about, you know, societal influence and notions of the natural, and now let's apply that to the issue of body size. I have encountered some resistance sometimes, but usually it goes very smoothly, surprisingly.
Well, but like you said, like you kind of do it in baby steps. You know,
absolutely.
So you
kinda... I want to build them up to, you know, and usually for these students who many of them, you know, in New York, it's a design school, you know, for all aspects of design. They like to think of themselves as being quite liberal often.
Right.
And many of them also have very much interests in notions of kind of non-normative gender or identity in general. So they want to think that they're open to broader issues. And this kind of puts them to the test. And I do put them to the test in the classroom when it comes to this.
That's so awesome. I'm sorry. Well, I also play
on their like of me. So, you know, so by the time it's the end of the semester, if they do challenge me, I then refer to myself as a kind of specific example. So, you know, if you say that producing plus size clothing only promotes obesity, if you will, then I say to them, well, what do you suggest that I do?
Right.
You know, do I walk around in sack clothes, you know, until I have a body that's acceptable by society? Because I think in many cases, I might be the largest person that they've had a significant relationship with in some sense.
Right. And who cannot like you?
thank you. I try to be likable in the classroom.
So, I mean, what kinds of, I can only imagine, like, the kinds of doors that you're opening for these students in terms of the way that they perceive the world and the way that they understand their own bodies and its larger kind of relationship with the world. And I would imagine that in the kind of work that you do with the kind of students that you're working with, there are a whole host of other ways that you could kind of bring in challenging and critical notions.
Well, you know, it's important to me, especially for the students that I teach who are first years, to really give them a sense of how important design is and what an effect it has on people's lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, you know, when you're a size 6 and you're 18 years old, you have very little concept of the idea of how seating can actually disenfranchise somebody. So it's really, I put out the goal to myself is to give them the notion that what they're doing in the future can actually give people agency and
right.
give them, you know, a lot of opportunities or just prevent them from being, you know, from not being able to use a space, et cetera. And, I want them to really feel like what they're doing actually has some teeth in social change.
I think part of what's amazing about what you're doing, or at least what I find so amazing about it, is that you've found ways to introduce these kinds of topics and ideas into the classes that you're, like, just quote unquote normally teaching. I think a lot of us who are, you know, kind of fat study scholars and academics in this area, we kind of have like this dream of like the day when our university will finally let us teach like a, you know, fat studies 101, you know, kind of class. But for most of us, that will never be a realized dream. And so we could learn so much from you in the sense of instead of kind of focusing on this long away dream of, well, once I have my own class, it's just about this, the cool things I can do. Instead, say, right, what can I do in the classes I currently have now to bring in and to integrate these concepts in a way that's meaningful for the students?
Absolutely. I mean, I really try to design my classes around, it's kind of like it seems like it's something that just happens at the end, but really when I'm structuring my syllabus, you know, that nugget, that whole fat studies element is what I'm thinking to myself, how can I build to that naturally?
Mm.
You know, and I'm teaching a class, for example, next semester on food in fine art. And presentation, consumption, and just such. So it's really, you know, issues of gluttony, you know, the consumption of food, the production of food.
Right.
All of these appeal to it as well. So, yeah, you know, it's I found it's a very effective way. Parsons has been wonderfully supportive.
Yay, Parsons.
So it's really worked out. To my delight.
That's awesome. Well, listen, Leah, we're just about out of time for today.
Okay.
But thank you so
much
for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for
having me. I do hope that you'll come back someday and talk more about what you're doing.
I would love to. Thank you so much.
Excellent. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Spotlight today is a piece from The Fat Chick titled Never Good Enough, How a Big Body Means You're Doing It Wrong. This piece was published on October 17, 2012. Quote, one of the things I find deeply frustrating as a fat woman is the assumption by many complete strangers that I'm not doing enough for my health. And the more I appear in public and on television, the more I hear this criticism leveled at me. No matter what I am doing for my health, clearly I am not doing enough because, well, look at me. And if I should claim to be doing something far beyond what another person is doing, then I must be lying. For example, I am a fitness teacher. I exercise pretty regularly and moderately. But many people believe that clearly I'm neither exercising hard enough nor the right way. Because look at me. I'm still fat. I should lift more weights. I should exercise at a higher intensity. I should do the Fred the Celebrity Super Insane Fitness Plan. Forget that I might get injured. Forget that I would hate it and quit after a few workouts. The folks that know everything about everything are glad to let me know that since they are thin and I am fat, I'm not working out as well as them. And when I tell them that when I was training for the marathon and walking and running up to 35 miles a week, I still maintain this weight, they tell me I must have been eating at least 4,000 calories per day, or that I'm lying. People who are conventionally thin don't get this treatment. If a conventionally thin person says they exercise 45 minutes per week, they are usually told to keep doing what they're doing because they look great. The same is true about eating. Many people assume that since I'm big, I eat nothing but junk food. I eat large amounts of food, and of course, I eat all the time. In pre-interviews for certain public appearances, I'm grilled over and over about what I eat, when I eat, how much I eat, and so on. No thin woman has ever asked these questions. It is assumed that if they are thin, they are eating well. But the producers ask these questions of me because A, they think their audience will wonder, and they're probably right, and B, they just can't imagine that I'm not eating the whole house because, well, look at me. We have been conditioned so deeply to believe that fat people do unhealthy things, and fat people do healthy things that we assume that we know by looking at someone, what their habits are. In the name of full disclosure, I would say that my eating habits are pretty average. I eat more than some and less than others. I eat more junk food than some and less than others. And many people who eat more than me weigh less than me. As comforting as the idea is that we can control every aspect of our appearance and our health outcomes with our behaviors, it simply isn't true. So all we can do is what seems to be the best for us at the time. There's no perfect exercise regimen. There's no perfect diet. There are no perfect people. They're just people. So the next time you look in the mirror and decide that your size means you aren't doing the right healthy things or doing enough healthy things, maybe that's the time to just stop. You don't have to put yourself into the same box as society does. Make your own plans and build your own life. Build a life that is joyous and right for you. Love the fat chick. End quote. Thanks for listening to another episode of Friend of Maryland. Friend of Maryland is brought to you by Access Manawatu 999 AM. If you'd like to contact the show with questions, comments, concerns, or suggestions for topics or guests, please email us, friendofmaryland@aol.com. You can also find Friend of Maryland on Twitter and Tumblr. Closing the show is Savannah Churchill with Time Out for Tears.